Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, let's pretend you're a small-town newspaper editor, and one of your best buddies calls you and begs you to kill a story that's going to be on the front page of your paper. It's about her drunken brother. She wants to keep it out of the paper because it might kill her mother, who's real sick. And, you know, just do this as a friend for me. What does the newspaper editor do? Well, we're going to find out from our guest today is John Staples, who is the former editor of the Kernersville News and the author of a book that I've read and enjoyed called White Lies and Other Deceptions, a novel from the Corners Hill Chronicle. John Staples, welcome.
Thank you very much, DG. It's a pleasure.
Corners Hill sounds a lot like Kernersville.
And that was deliberate.
And the Chronicle could be the Kernersville News, where you worked for a long time.
That was the reason I chose that title. And I chose Corners Hill because I researched it and didn't find any other town in the United States by the name of Corners Hill. There is a town in Canada by that name.
Back named Corners Hill.
So the novel hasn't reached that town, so I haven't gotten it. Direct feedback from that.
Well, tell us, I want to talk about the story. It's an interesting sort of, I'd call it a mystery story, but it's also, in some respects, a description of life as a small town newspaper editor. And maybe before we talk about the book, you tell us about your life as a small town newspaper editor. What's it like to... What's it like when your friend calls you and says, could you kill a story?
Well, that's not the better part of it, but it is a great life. It's, you know, I heard many people, Charles Carroll, others who said it was a job they would do for free if they had some other means of income. And it was, that was my main motivation getting into the newspaper business, was simply to observe and report what went on. And I've said, of course, in the book that that I took some cues from John O'Hara, who had been in the newspaper business. And he said he got out of the newspaper business and started writing novels so he could, quote, tell the truth. I think what he meant was he wanted to tell the whole truth.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you went there because some of the most provocative parts of the book are those where you present some of the dilemmas that come to a small town newspaper editor. And this one whom you portray is pretty consistent in saying, when people say, don't print this, he says, I got to print this. But in the second breath, you say, but we don't print everything. We can't tell the whole truth. And so how can we count on the small town editor to tell us the whole truth in the newspaper? Or do you have to wait till he writes his novel?
I think that may be the case in some instances. There's always a broad, you know, I like to say to people that people would come up to me over the years and say, I thought the newspaper told the truth. And I would say, newspapers never tell the truth. They tell what they know about the truth, which in my view was just a small fraction of the overall picture, because we never know the entire background. We never know what's going on under the surface.
Yeah, well, I thought that was an interesting part of your book where you confess that the newspapers can't tell the whole truth because you don't know the whole truth.
You don't know the whole truth.
You can tell what you know of the whole truth. But pressing you on this piece of it, there are always parts of the story that the newspaper reporter or editor knows that he or she does not tell for one reason or another.
Right.
So it's not the whole truth, we agree about it, and it's not all the truth that we know about this particular story.
Right. And I think
what are the kinds of things that you don't tell?
That happens quite a bit. Well, one of the things that in this book that I told about, of course, a part of this book, I would say 80% of this book is fact. Disguised fact. The other 20% of it is totally fiction. The plot of it was fiction. A lot of the incidents in it actually happened. The incident you referred to where the brother's, a friend's brother was inebriated and he got he got into an incident in which it made a great picture for the front page of the paper. And when I went to write the novel, I said, I really don't want to upset this family any more than I've already upset them, because I came to the conclusion that this picture had to be printed.
Too good a picture, told too much, too many people knew about it.
Too many people knew about it and all that sort of thing. So when I wrote it, I changed the facts to have a guy who was inebriated turn on the railroad track and run his car down the railroad track. Well, almost a year later, I was talking to Barber in Kernersville, and he said, and I was talking to him about that incident. He said, well, John, I remember when so-and-so ran their car down the railroad. They were inebriated and ran their car down the railroad. So what I had attempted to make fiction was actually something that had happened in fact.
Wow. Well, can I press you on this just a little bit more? Because I got in the shoes of the newspaper editor, and in this particular case where there's a drunk, inebriated person, and I'd say in the fictional character, but it introduced all the choices that have to be made. One of the reasons that the editor had for going ahead and printing the picture was that already so many people knew about it that if he didn't, he would be in trouble for concealing it. And so it made me, when he gave that reason, it made me wonder, well, what if you just taken the picture, nobody else knew about it, and the woman had come to you, would it have been a different situation?
It may have been somewhat different. There is a book, D.G., called The Thin Red Line. I don't know whether you've ever seen it or not. It is about decisions that editors have to make, and some of them are very thin as to whether you hold a story, you don't hold a story, and so on. And all kinds of things play into that as to whether you're going to run that story or you're
so. I guess so. There would be occasions similar to this one where you maybe just say that the your friend who had said her mother was sick. If she had said, "My mother is on death's door, and you really will be responsible for her death," and you came to believe that, then probably you would kill the story.
That might have been the case. Yeah. That's possible, I think.
Well, you talked about the joy of being a small-town newspaper editor. Was this part of the joy, these little ethical decisions that you – I mean, ones where there's not a perfect solution, but you do have to make a judgment about it, and you're going to be criticized whichever way you go. Some people would say that's terrible, that's a horrible part of the business. Other people would say, well, you know, I like that part of that. Where were you on that?
No, I usually enjoyed that when I could make a decision and not, you know – not suffer too greatly with it. I mean, there are cases where you might put your life in danger by running a story or whatever, and people do that. But having the ability to make that decision is part of what makes life fun sometimes.
Well, listen, this book that you've written in your retirement, I got a feeling you might have written part of it along the way. You might have had part of it at least in the back of your mind while you were working too, but you retired as a newspaper editor, and then your first novel, or your first, I think it's your first published book, right, is about is White Lies and Other Deceptions. John, it's obviously set in a town much like Kernersville where you worked, and it's obviously based on your experience. You said it's 80% fact and 20% fiction. Tell us the fictional story. I want to talk first about the fictional story, and then I want to probe the pieces of it that might be part of, say, your memoir.
Well, the plot is, as you know, is set around a female lawyer in the town who is presumably run off the road by a drunken driver or by a hit and run driver of some type, and her car goes into a ravine and hits a tree. She's knocked unconscious, goes into a coma. She stays in that coma for like 6 months or whatever. That's entirely fictional. The whole basis of the plot around which I tried to hang a lot of the other pieces of the story was simply a way to put the story together and keep people interested turning the page so that they would want to know, you know, who ran this lady off the road and why and that sort of thing.
Is that the key to a mystery, is that you introduce a puzzle and just tease your readers all the way along?
I mean, in my view, it is to some degree. I mean, some people do it better than others. one of the reasons that I called it White Lies and Other Deceptions was because I was a great fan of Scott Turow, and particularly his book Presumed Innocent, because I thought that was the most perfect title I ever saw after I read the book and saw that while everybody in the book was presumed innocent, nobody was innocent. Not a soul in the book who's innocent.
Well, the is that all there is to the story, to the mystery story? A woman gets run off the road, and we find out over a period of time what happened.
That's a lot of the mystery story, but a lot of it comes in with the women who are involved and what their relationships have been, the psychologist and her relationship, her having been a law student. And part of that, if you remember the scene where she is being questioned on elements of criminal law.
Yeah. You're giving this away, so I'll help you along. The central character, the mystery part of the story is this woman lawyer in Corners Hill, North Carolina. And she had been a law teacher at a Western, at a university that had WF.
Right.
Not Wake Forest, but could have been Wake Forest.
Right.
And she had a student, and you set up a funny scene in that, which we don't know is going to be very important later on in the book. But basically, this is a law school classroom that I can imagine, and you've got this powerful woman, later a lawyer in Kernsville, now a teacher at WF University. And there's she's a woman teacher, and she's picking on this poor, reticent woman law student, and they're going over the elements of rape.
Right.
And so you can imagine that it's going to be embarrassing, and surrounded by all these male students, that this woman has to describe what's going on in that situation. And then that later becomes an important part of the it seems like just kind of an interesting story. So you kind of throw that in there. Is that what mystery writers do?
Throw them in and then make them important later on? I think the way I write, which is I don't consider myself an accomplished novelist by any means, but I wrote this whole book without changing a word until I got to the very end of it. And then I had to take out about 120 pages of it because it just didn't relate well to the rest of the book. People have told me I should have taken another 100 pages out of it, perhaps. But that incident, which supposedly happened, I was a law school student, and I know you are a lawyer, I believe. Is that right?
Well, I've got a license, but there's a question about whether or not I'm competent to practice.
Well, did you go to Chapel Hill to law school?
I went to Yale to law school.
Yale, okay.
The classroom was very vivid and very real.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, this incident about this questioning of this very reticent law student, female law student, was a joke that was told 40 years ago at Chapel Hill. I went to law school at Chapel Hill for a year. Found out I had no aptitude for being a lawyer.
Well, you were smart enough to get out early.
Either smart enough or dumb enough, I'm not sure. But that incident was told as a joke, but I'm not totally sure it was a joke.
It could have happened. It made more sense in those days where female law students were two or three in a class rather than now the 60%
right.
of the class that
absolutely.
They are now.
Absolutely.
Well, we're talking to John Staples, who is a recently retired small-town newspaper editor of the Kernersville News. He's written a novel called White Lies and Other Deceptions. He's written another book that we're going to talk about later on. John Staples and I'll be right back after this short break.
Now it's time for Getting It Together, brought to you by Hold Your Own, Organizing and Storage Solutions.
The November and December holidays are over, and it's time to pack decorations away for next year. I'm Katrina Lamberto, professional organizer and productivity consultant, helping you get it together after the holidays. If there are ornaments in your storage boxes you never unpacked, give them to family members or donate them. You can pick up red and green ornament storage boxes and Christmas tree storage bags at Hold Your Own. By using colored dots and clear plastic bins, you can organize your decorations and tchotchkes by the season or holiday. Brown for fall, blue for the 4th, orange for Halloween, or yellow for spring, labeling now makes it easier to find later. For more of my tips, visit catlamdy.com.
This has been Getting It Together, brought to you by Hold Your Own and Eastgate Shopping Center, organizing and storage solutions.
I got the can opener. Freddie, I still can't believe you got stuck in a ram's head beer can of all the...
Now I know how a sardine feels. Get me out of here.
Okay, okay. Let's see here. Wait a sec.
Ron, what are you doing? Ron, you didn't. You're not...
Freddie!
Great, now what? At least you know how I got sucked into a ram's head beer can.
I saw them on the counter and I just had to have some, so I took a big long swig and here I am.
Yeah, now we're two canned hams. How are we getting out of here? I can't believe you...
Well, you got sucked first.
Well, I know, but you're supposed to be rescuing me.
Well, you shouldn't have gotten in there in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, look who's talking. Big radio man in a beer can. Who's gonna do the morning show now?
The new canned microbrew from Top of the Hill is so good, we have to issue this warning. Don't get sucked into the can.
Hey, Ron, want to do some trivia?
Shut up, Freddy.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. John Staples, a former editor of the Kernersville News. Kernersville used to be a small town between Greensboro and Winston-Salem and High Point as well, near the airport, is now a big town, big and growing town. John, you edited the newspaper for, 25 years. And maybe you worked there for a few years before they made you the editor. We're talking about your book and the mystery story that we've talked about, an interesting feature, but you said that's only 20% of the book. You really used this fiction to create your memoir, didn't you?
I did. Absolutely. I wrote the book. I've told many people I wrote the book initially just to let my kids and my wife know what I was doing when I wasn't home all that time, which was a lot of time that I was not. So...
Well, I would say, by and large, you portray your friends and neighbors in a positive, uplifting way. But not all, but all of us want to be portrayed totally positive, and you haven't got everybody totally positive. What's been the reaction in Kernersville? Have you had to defend yourself among your friends? Some
surprisingly, not very much. One of the most interesting reactions I get is that people will come up to me and say, "Jonna, like the book, I knew every character in it." And I want to say to them, "Well, that's interesting, since at least five or six of them are totally fiction."
Totally fiction. But there are some who obviously, some of the people at the newspaper seem to be very real. Some of the political figures seem to be very real. For instance, the mayor whom you portray is a very realistic sounding person. You had a strong mayor over in Kernersville,
absolutely,
much like this. Is
absolutely
that him? Is it him?
I would say that is 90%. You know, that's him as I remember him. He was a great fellow. I've been a diehard Yellow Dog Democrat all my life, and he was a Republican.
Uh-huh. You had to kind of be a Republican in that.
But he was a small-town Republican, uh-huh, who was a little-D Democrat, actually, uh-huh, in my view. And so we got along very well. We clashed at times. But for the most part, you know, I thought he did an excellent job.
What the other thing that interested me, what about the police and sheriff figures that you created? Were they makeup figures, or did you have particular people in mind when you described them?
Grady Stockton was the police chief in Kernersville for many years, and he is the guy that I have called Stanfield Grady.
Uh-huh.
The police chief. And
so you just kind of messed around with his name a little bit.
And I messed around with his name a little bit. But his character I tried to portray, he was a very laconic person who hardly ever said anything unless you ask him a question. And he was not forthcoming with a lot of information. And that's, you know, part of the plot of the novel is trying to dig out what's going on. And you're getting various stories from him.
Well, it intrigued me because it was something that I hadn't thought about a lot, and that is the relationship that a newspaper editor or reporter or a small town would develop with the police. And the one of the questions that came up is again, this goes back to what you print and what you don't print, is when the police takes you into confidence and says, now, I don't want to print this, I want to tell you this, but I don't want you to print it. Did that come up very often with your real police chief, and describe the relationship that you had?
That comes up every now and then. I thought we had a very good relationship. I'd known this police chief since I was like 9 years old, and he was the kind of guy who, if he found a drinking driver in the town back when I was young, he would simply tell him to park his car and he'd drive him home and not charge him with anything. He'd just say, stay off, you know, he would give him admonition, say, stay off the road or whatever. And
if you do this again, I'm going to call you in.
Yeah, it was like Mayberry RFD almost. I mean, it was really a small town thing. But there were situations in which, you know, were serious. And occasionally something would come up. And there were, as I recall, when I was small, there were bootleggers in the town. My father knew a lot of them, as a matter of fact. There were people who probably ran little gambling operations. And they, you know, the police department simply tried to live and let live for the most part. And if something got out of hand, then they, you know, or if something got really serious, then they had to do something about it.
So there was a lot of discretion in a small town when you were growing up in the early days as a reporter, where the chief of police and the other law enforcement people made decisions not to vigorously enforce the law in certain areas if it wasn't causing a lot of trouble.
Right.
And what now? One of the great things about your book is that you describe this wonderful. It wouldn't be right to call it houses of prostitution, but there was a little bit of hanky panky going on, kind of high class hanky panky going on in your novel. And I want to ask John, was that really going on, or was that the 20%?
It wasn't really. This lady.
Tell us then the true story.
This lady had an operation that was supposedly a prostitution and abortion ring in Winston-Salem. And it was known by practically all of the upper class and middle class of Winston-Salem. And she owned a house in Kernersville, which I did not know about. And in the book, I learn about that house simply by reading a column.
This is all true.
All this is true. I can tell you.
Well, tell us.
I can tell you her name. Her name was Madge Roberts.
All right. And you read about this was 20 years ago? You read about this?
This was about 30 years ago. I got up one morning and read a column by
one of the Winston-Salem journals.
Thompson, Roy Thompson, who was my favorite columnist in Winston-Salem. And he made reference to this woman who had this little black book, and that it was filled with so many important names that it could upset the entire balance of the legislature or whatever. He never said, he intimated that she was involved in these peccadilloes or whatever, and he never said who she was or what she'd done. About 6 months later, the Winston-Salem Journal came out with a story that this lady had been arrested on tax evasion charges.
A federal charge.
Federal charge.
But the state people had never clamped down. Local people never clamped down.
Never claimed anything. The local people never claimed to have her on anything. And but it was well known that she ran a business. And later, after I wrote this book, a fire chief in Kernersville told me, he says, well, John, said, everybody knew Madge. He said Madge was the primary entertainment for a meeting of the National Fire Chiefs Association in Winston-Salem one time.
That threw me back to the question that you raised in your book, and that is, what does a small town newspaper editor do when he finds out that probably some of his the leading lights of the community are involved in an illegal activity. Does he take the position of the police chief, well, it's not causing any trouble, so we won't make a big deal out of it? Or does he say, this is a violation of the law that my readers are interested in, I'm going to tell them what? And how did you come down?
Yeah, no, I don't think he takes a position that, you know, this is just a minor violation of the law. In this case, this story developed over a period of a year. And when I first read that column, I had no idea who this lady was. And I started asking questions that morning when I read the column, if anybody knew. And it happened that this sheriff's deputy, who is now deceased, he told me who the lady was. And he said, everybody knows, you know, this lady. and he told me she has a house in Kernersville. And then I started going out and checking around the neighborhood to find out who she was and what they knew about her. And, you know, you've read part of it in the novel. You find out all kinds of things about her.
Well, you take from moving back, put yourself back in the shoes as the author of the novel. You've got an interesting situation, at least based on reality, and it's too good to leave out. So you string it into your novel. Now, what are the challenges to make it relevant to a mystery story? How did you tackle this challenge?
Well, that particular element was simply something that I had found to be one of the most interesting stories I'd covered. The Journal actually picked up one of my stories, the time that I ran that this lady had a house in Kernersville. Joe Piccarello, who was a reporter for the Journal, is now with the Miami Herald, I think. He picked that story up and ran a front page story on it and gave us credit. The first time they'd ever given us credit for a story almost. And so it was just an interesting situation.
Well, now let me press you on this. So there's just an interesting tidbit that you're going to put in your book, whether it fits in the story or not.
Well, the nice thing about being a reporter is that you cover all kinds of
I'm talking about you as a novelist now, not as a reporter. As a novelist, you got a story that's interesting that might not exactly fit in the story. What do you do? I mean, but you got to put, you say, this is too good not to put in my book.
That's one of the biggest criticisms I've got of the book, that it's a book of anecdotes about newspaper reporting and not.
Well, it would be one of the greatest criticisms, might be also one of the greatest compliments, that it's a great collection of anecdotes strung together on the string of a mystery story.
Right.
You know, that's. Well, listen, Les, you and I take a break because I've gone way over. I'm talking to John Staples, retired newspaper editor from Kernersville, who's written a book called White Lies and Other Deceptions based on his experience as a small town newspaper editor. And we'll be right back.
At Molly Mead of Chapel Hill, we know that many of you have made some pretty hefty New Year's resolutions. We can't tell you how to lose weight or how to work less, but we can help you find more time in your day to see those New Year's resolutions through. Each Molly Mead team is insured, bonded, and supervised. And if one of your resolutions was to spend less money, Molly Mead costs less than you think, and the time you'll get in return is priceless. Call us for an estimate today, 967-0123. Molly Mead of Chapel Hill, helping you start the new year with a clean slate.
Do you have anxiety about going to the dentist? At Dr. Robinson's office, we know that it is very common for people to feel nervous about dental work. In fact, many people will put off going to the dentist because they are afraid. But having regular dental cleanings and oral exams is part of your body's overall health. If you are the type of person that avoids the dentist because of anxiety, you could be a candidate for sedation dentistry. For more information about sedation dentistry or to schedule your appointment with Dr. Teresa Robinson, please call 942-5559.
The High & Rubish Insurance Agency is an independent insurance agency serving our community for over 40 years. Why should you work with an independent agent? Because an independent agent works for you, not a big insurance company. Now is the time to be sure that you have the right insurance coverage for you and your family. So call High & Rubish for your free insurance review. High & Rubish will assess your insurance needs and make sure you have the coverage you need. Many of the insurance reviews High & Rubish completes result in no insurance change. Isn't that reassuring? Wouldn't you like to be sure you're covered? You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by calling High & Rubish today for your free insurance review. Call 913-1144, 913-1144, or stop by 6015 Farrington Road in Chapel Hill. High & Rubish Insurance, when you need to be sure.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360. WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to John Staples, the author of White Lies and Other Deceptions, a book, a mystery story based on his experience as the editor of the Kernersville News, and I've been sitting here with him sort of separating fact and fiction. John, I want to move away from the story. It's a great, it is a wonderfully interesting book, and thanks for writing it. From my point of view, as much for the mystery as to see what the life of the life I never led, which is of a small town newspaper editor. I'd like for you to talk to us about the experience of writing and publishing your first book. In my experience, this is a tough proposition, both sitting down and writing it, getting it in shape, dealing with what you know are the weaknesses of it, trying to put it in shape, trying to sell it to a publisher, more often than not being able to, an agent or a publisher, more often than not, that's not successful. And then arranging for the publication. So, will you tell us about this journey?
Well, all that I know, and what I know is basically the easy part of it is writing the book. the most difficult part
well,
of it is...
Well, was it easy to write this book?
In my view, it was easy to write.
How'd you do it?
I did it in part because I waited
how?
A long time.
How did you do it? How did you do it? Did you just sit down every morning after retirement and write it?
I sat down before I retired. I started writing the book. About a year before I retired, I was having some problems with sinus, and I'd wake up after 4 hours of sleep, and oftentimes I'd go to bed at 10 o'clock and wake up at 2, and I'd be awake, and I would go in and I started writing. Several things started me off on that. I made a trip up to Abingdon, Virginia, and on our way into Abingdon, I saw this house, and I told my wife, I saw that house before. 3 years ago, and she said, "Where did you see this house?" And I saw it. I said, "I saw it in a dream 3 years ago," and I'd never been on that road in Abingdon before. And I actually stopped and went to the house trying to find out who owned it and what had come of. I came back and I wrote a little 2-page description of the house, and I said that it looked like it had been had something to do with the Civil War or that soldiers had been there. Well, 3 years later, I was back up there and found out who had owned this house, and it had at one time been the headquarters of General John Hunt Morgan of Morgan's Raiders in the Civil War. Why that became something else. That's the way I started to write the book. It started off being a kind of autobiographical thing and something about my family. My father was from Virginia, and I thought, well, maybe I'd been by here before or something like that.
Wow,
and I'm still trying to find out.
So the book got started to try to deal with a mystery that still is not solved.
That is still a mystery. Yeah. Yes.
And then once you say that's the easy part, you wrote it. And then what about? Did you seek help? Did you get editors? Did you try to get it published?
I had six or seven different people read the book in the initial stage. It was about 400 pages when I initially wrote it, and not all of them were professionals. A few of them were, but many of them said, you know, you've got too much here, and most of them told me you've got two books and you need to separate some of this material. And so I had to do that, which was not extremely difficult. Joe Goodman, who used to be the managing editor of the Journal, I'm sure you know Joe, he he read the book in one sitting, and he told me, he said, there are some things you should have still left out of it. It still needs to be a little tighter, and I think he was exactly mm-hmm. right. But no, I wrote it. I did not change a word from the beginning of the book to the end of it until you started cutting.
So you wrote it all the way through and then started editing it yourself.
And then I started editing it myself.
What about once you got the product that you felt you wanted to share? What about the conversations with publishers, and how'd you choose the route that you took?
I had talked with a lot of people who had published books and so on, and I had read about the publishing field and how difficult it is to break into the publishing field these days. And I decided, well, this is going to be a book that has more interest for this local audience anyway, and I'll just self-publish the book and see what I can do. And I sold about 700 books in Kernersville.
Wow.
Which was a good deal. It paid for the costs and everything, and I made enough to buy myself a new computer.
Well, what about choosing? You know, there are all kinds of options. What are the options available to a author who wants to publish something in the self-publishing field as you see it now, having, you know, examined them? And I guess you're keeping an eye on that as well.
Well, in the computer age, it's very easy to format a book, put it into the format that you want, put in the typefaces, do the covers. And that is, I did all of both of the books that I have done on the PageMaker computer program that we used in the newspaper, and set it up and outlined it and everything. So that part of it is
that part you were able to do yourself. Many authors would need a little bit of help.
Many authors would need some help on that. But I was able to do that myself.
And, so once you have the organization of it, it's just a matter then of arranging with a printer to print the book. Is that about it?
With a printer. This book was printed by R.R. Donnelly in Chicago, which is a big printing house.
And why'd you choose them?
Well, first, I went through a person who was a publisher, Jeff Pate. Jeff was used to be a High Point policeman. And he wrote a couple of novels and was fairly successful with his novels. And he decided to start publishing his own. And he started being a publisher, and I got him to help me with the first one. And he was he did a good job of it, I thought. He put me in touch with every bookstore in the country and whatever. But knowing who they are and how to reach them and how to distribute that book, that becomes the difficult part.
Well, is this a fair characterization that when you're self-publishing, the bulk of your sales are going to come from your personal efforts and contacts rather than having somebody nationally get this book out in the market?
They really are. Everything that I learned said that even if you have a national publisher, you're still responsible for doing most of the marketing of that book and selling it yourself.
Well, we're talking with John Staples, who's the author of White Lies and Other Deceptions, and I'll be right back.
Podcasting, come get your podcast. 1360 WCHL is now podcasting the WCHL Morning News with Ron Stutz and Who's Talking Today with T.G. Martin. Miss your favorite show or just want to hear it again? Go to WCHL1360.com and click on podcasting. Download your favorite show when and where you want. Put it on your iPod or listen on your computer. Everybody's doing it. WCHL1360.com. That's WCHL1360.com. Podcasting daily.
Open Sesame.
Teach your children well.
Community Independent School is hosting an open house this Sunday, January 29th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. The open house welcomes families from the community to campus to visit with teachers and students currently attending our school. It is a great opportunity to learn more about Community Independent School. See the beautiful 3-acre campus and experience it with your own eyes. And better still, you can let your children dive into the fun activities with their own hands. Call 932-6313 or visit communityindependentschool.org for direction and details. Community Independent School, providing dynamic, hands-on education, preschool through fourth grade, located in Chatham County, minutes from Chapel Hill.
Don't miss the open house this Sunday from 1 to 3.
Teach your children well.
WCHL 1360, time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
He believed that God had chosen him to lead an army and that he was by his side in every battle. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Hey, Coach Jimmy Johnson, what are you doing at Sam's Club?
Stocking up for my big game party. I got this 50-inch high-definition plasma TV, buffalo hot wings, party trays, and 10 bags of Tostitos.
Tostitos? I'm going long. Throw me a bag.
I don't think so.
Aisle 15, I'm open.
Somebody get a stretcher. That's gotta hurt.
Sam's Club. Everything you need for great big game memories is here. So stock up and save big on great food items, electronics, and more. 10% service fee applies to all non-member purchases.
Some say he doubted his own courage, and so he was reckless with his life. Some say he was only happy when in battle. Some saw a humble man. Others saw a brash general with no regard for rules. The truth? Maybe all of these. He was born in San Gabriel, California, and despite his dyslexia, graduated from West Point in 1909. He served in Mexico, and in World War I, led his tank brigade from the front on foot. He was shot and almost died. In World War II, he beat the British into Sicily, but he also slapped two shell-shocked American soldiers who he considered cowards. As punishment, he was sent to England, while others led the invasion of Normandy. Once in France, he led his men relentlessly, covering 600 miles in 2 weeks. It was the fastest army advance in history. The general emerged a hero, but his reckless tongue embarrassed the army, and he was sidelined after the war. Ironically, after all the dangers of battle, a car accident took the life of American General George Patton. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been talking to John Staples, a retired newspaper editor from Kernersville, about the life of a small-town newspaper man and then how he put it in the context of a mystery story, obviously set in Kernersville, there between Winston-Salem and Greensboro. John, you've got another book out. I haven't read it, but this is a book that reflects sort of a new direction in your life, I think. Will you tell us about, very briefly? We haven't got a lot of time.
It's almost a new direction, but Zen is something that intrigued me. Just during the hippie days, there was a lot of discussion about Zen. I began, the title of the book is Make Love, Drive Freeway, Every Now and Zen.
Make Love.
Drive Freeway.
Drive Freeway, Every Now and Zen.
And Zen. The basis of that is that I had read a book by a lady called Charlotte Joko Beck, who is a California Zen master. And in the preface to her book, her editor, Steve Smith, said that was an ancient Buddhist or Zen phrase, which means that if you want to be enlightened, you do what needs to be done. Like if you eat breakfast, you wash your bowl. If you need what needs to be done every moment of every day, you will be an enlightened person. You'll do what needs to be done, which is almost the total of Zen in a way. And he said, but that phrase needed to be modernized and changed to make love, drive freeway. The expression that needed to be changed was, their expression was chop wood, carry water. And they used that expression for like 1,500 years.
So make love, drive freeway.
Freeway.
That's what we do.
That's what we do.
And what's then the point of your of the thinking that you share in this short book? What is what when I read the book, what are you going to teach me?
Well, I started into the book because I had done a Werner Erhard seminar, what used to be the old S training.
Right.
And it absolutely
controversial, but
very controversial. And it has become now called the Forum, but it changed my life 180 degrees.
So you're an S disciple.
I am an S graduate, is what they call them. I'm not a disciple by any.
Well, I'm just pushing you. You characterize
right.
it.
I no,
mean, but I mean, we come to think of you guys as pretty, you know, set in this way of looking at things.
Yeah, and I think that was the smart thing Erhard did. Erhard separated anything that he did from any religious connotation, because he knows that people come to misconceptions, preconceptions, and all that anytime you mention anything religious. So
this is not religious, but it's in some respects spiritual, secular spiritualism, almost.
You could identify that. Although
what
he makes
part of it, though, what
out.
Part of it are you share? What part of it you feel? Like,
well,
you can share in a popular book.
As far as the book goes, the Zen, I came to believe that Erhard's training used a lot of Zen techniques. They ask impossible questions, questions you cannot answer. Well, that's pretty much the same thing that a Zen master does. You know, what's the sound of one hand clapping, what is the meaning of when the hill is steep, the water is cool, or, you know, this kind of thing. And the whole purpose of it is to stop you from thinking.
To stop you from thinking?
To stop you from thinking. Stopping you from thinking is...
If there's an imponderable, if there's something you can't answer, that shuts down the thinking process.
It shuts down your process.
And that's good.
And in many cases, that's good. Because about 95% of our thinking is what I would call speculative thinking. The other part is functioning thinking. In other words, I have to think to open the door or something. But too many times we're going through this process of what if, well, you know, all that kind of thing. And in many cases, that stops us in our life and what we're trying to do. That if we worry about it, if we think too much about it. I go back to the old thing in Julius Caesar, where I think it was Brutus who said to Mark Antony, or somebody said, look, behold yon Cassius, he had a lean and hungry look. He thinks too
Such
much.
Such men are dangerous.
Such men are dangerous.
They think too much. Mm-hmm.
And the whole process of Oriental thought, in many cases, is to stop you from having too much speculative thinking. Because that leads
So the drive is to focus on what you got to do and do that, and from time to time or for all time to shut down the thinking process. Is that just something? Is that an exercise, or is that something a condition?
I would say
that
the process is to realize the difference between what is real and what isn't real. That was part of the White Lies book too, is to say these things are what is, and this is what truth is. What is truth is what happens. A book I read by Ron Smotherman says. And people would disagree with this, but he says belief is unnecessary. He says, because if a thing is true, it's true whether you believe it or not. Now, he doesn't say belief is insignificant or that it's unimportant or anything like that, because belief drives the world in pretty much. But he says, you know, if a thing is true, it's true whether you believe it or not. So he takes some of that speculation out of it.
Well, John Staples, I wish we had more time to talk about these other ideas, but I sure had fun talking to you about White Lies and Other Deceptions, your book about your experience as an editor in what's called Corners Hill, but is really Kernersville. And we're glad you took time to visit us in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And want to thank John and all of you all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
I enjoyed it very much.
At home, at work, in the car. News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel.